Tom Gelton of NPR News. I'm sitting in for Diane. She's wrapping up her visit to Cuba. She'll be back next week. On my mind this week, concerns about North Korea. On Wednesday, speaking aboard the USS Ronald Reagan in Japan, Vice President Mike Pence had this warning.
Those who would challenge our resolve or our readiness should know. We will defeat any attack and meet any use of conventional or nuclear weapons with an overwhelming and effective American response.
I turned to Ambassador Chris Hill, a longtime U.S. diplomat, to give us some perspective on the U.S. response to the threat from North Korea and how it's changed. Then a conversation with Boston College political scientist Alan Wolf on how evangelicals have shifted their stance on the separation of church and state.
To them, the state was like Mephistopheles. The state was like the devil. It had designs on believers. And if you entered into an alliance with the state, it was like entering into an alliance with the devil.
First, joining me via Skype, Ambassador Chris Hill. He's Dean of the Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. Previously, he was U.S. ambassador to Iraq, and he headed the U.S. delegation to the six-party talks on the North Korean nuclear issue from 2005 to 2009. Ambassador Hill, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Of course, North Korea has been a big worry for a long time, but in these last couple of weeks, Americans seem to have really woken up to that danger. Are you getting people coming up to you? Are you getting students coming up to you and asking you if we're going to go to war in North Korea?
Yeah, I've had a lot of people ask me that question in the last few weeks. You know, not a lot has changed. They've been at this for a couple of decades, but I think the Trump administration just took notice. And I think there is a feeling that somehow we can talk them out of this. And I think it's going to take a little more than that. But, you know, I'll give them good credit for reaching out to the Chinese and the South Koreans.
Not exactly something that hasn't been tried before, right?
That's right. I mean, there's no rabbit that's going to come out of the hat here. You know, we've been stuffing those rabbits down the hat for many years, and it basically has to do with seeing if the Chinese can do more, not only in sanctions, but in other areas in terms of not-so-friendly persuasion. But also, we have to remember that the country that's really on the front line, the country that has some half of its population within North Korean artillery range, that is South Korea, we need to work with them very closely on this issue.
Well, Ambassador Hill, in the administrations that you've worked with, as well as the current administration, we've heard this phrase, all options are on the table. There's nothing new about that option. And yet it seems from, some of the things that President Trump has said that people are now sort of thinking more about what does that mean? All options are on the table.
Well, that's something that American officials often say when they're not really sure what to do because none of the options are particularly good. So they say all options are on the table. President Obama used that phrase to describe the Iran nuclear issue. But I think the implication, of course, is that if we can't talk our way through this, then we may have to use more direct means, that is military means. The problem with the military solution is you would really need your allies, especially South Korea, on board. And it's not at all clear that that's where they are on this, nor is it clear that the Chinese would stand by and allow this to happen. And in fact, during the past weekend, when there was a lot of tension being ratcheted up, the Chinese were very concerned about any solution that was not peaceful and diplomatic.
Well, of course, Vice President Pence was in North Korea this week.
Over the past 18 months, North Korea has conducted two unlawful nuclear tests and an unprecedented number of ballistic missile tests.
He made it sound like we're at a big turning point in U.S. policy toward Korea.
The era of strategic patience is over.
When he said the era of strategic patience is over, what did he mean by that?
Well, he actually misspoke on that. He suggested that a bunch of administrations had said, oh, we need to be patient and we need to have strategic patience, when in fact, it was an expression that came up during the Obama administration. Actually, it was first patient and then to sort of attach some kind of wisdom to it, they added the word strategic. But it was based on the notion that we need to be smart and careful and, you know, wait out our turn on this. In fairness to the Trump administration, it's quite clear that Kim Jong-un has no sense of patience. He is assiduously trying to put together a nuclear weapon that is deliverable to the U.S. mainland. He is not interested in negotiations at all, and in fact has never been interested in negotiations. So I think we have a problem here, and the question is what to do about it. Certainly asking China to do much more to enforce sanctions is important, but I think we need to understand that the sanctions train is moving slower than the North Korean nuclearization train. So that in and of itself will probably not suffice. So we really need to be in a sort of deep dive with the Chinese to talk about what our interests are and what our interests are not. For example, we're not interested in putting troops up on the Yalu River and in any way threatening Chinese strategic concerns. At the same time, we need to make it clear to the Chinese that if North Korea fails, it fails. So I think we have to figure out how to put a lot more pressure on North Korea, but avoid bellicose terms that are bluffs, because if North Korea calls the bluff and we're not prepared to follow through on the bluff, I think things could get even worse.
Well, even if Vice President Pence misspoke when he said the era of strategic patience is over, what are they trying to say? What's the opposite of strategic patience? Is that like impulsive impatience? I'm wondering.
Something like that. But I think the Trump administration is waking up to the fact that they don't want to tell the American people in the next 4 years, or face the American people, I should say, in 2020 in the next presidential election, that, well, we looked at this North Korean issue. We kind of gave it the junior college try. Nothing worked. So here we have another threat against the U.S. Mainland. So they don't really want to face the American people with that. So there is a sense of urgency, if you will. So maybe the opposite of patience is urgency in their understanding of it.
Now, you've said several times that if there's going to be a solution to the North Korea problem, it's going to have to be with China. And it seems clear that China is increasingly itself impatient with North Korea. So why is China holding back? Given the importance of China's trade and economic relationship with North Korea, it would seem that the Chinese could do so much more. What is holding them back, Ambassador Hill?
Well, first of all, their economic relationship with South Korea is far greater than their economic relationship with North Korea. But your question stands. The answer to it is often said that the Chinese are worried about if there's a North Korean implosion, there'll be all these refugees going into China. I really don't think that's it. I think it's much deeper. I think it's a concern about many Chinese national security people that somehow if North Korea goes down and the successor state is South Korea, that this will be a strategic victory for America and a strategic defeat for China. Moreover, I think within China, one has to understand that the relationship to a country like North Korea, they don't look at North Korea as another sovereign country. They look at it as a sort of tributary state. And so the idea is if North Korea goes down, then the whole system that China has, at least in their mind, of how they manage things begins to start unraveling. And they worry that somehow this could be the beginning of the end. And moreover, China has a longstanding, within China, there's quite a debate going on. What kind of system does China need in the future to propel this economy forward? And certainly, while China's system has little resemblance to North Korea's system these days, the idea of a Marxist-Leninist state on their border going down would certainly change the nature of that internal debate within China, where people who want more reform would be buoyed by the fact that the least reformed element, that is North Korea, has just gone down, and therefore China needs to start thinking about making major changes themselves. So it's caught up in all these kind of cosmic questions of whither China and what its internal systems are and what its relationship to its near abroad is. So very complex question for China, about which there's no consensus. And when there's no consensus in China, they fall back on 30-year-old talking points.
But that analysis seems to preclude the idea that China could actually reform North Korea, could actually change North Korea's behavior with pressure. I mean, it would seem to me that there's more options than just standing by and seeing North Korea go down. I mean, couldn't China actually influence Kim's behavior in some way?
Well, certainly the Chinese invited Kim's father many occasions to China to see some of their new industrial facilities, to point out that to Kim Jong-il, hey, this could all be yours. This could be your future if you would undergo the kinds of reforms we've undergone. And Kim Jong-il enjoyed the trips and then went back to Pyongyang and did precious little. Clearly, the Chinese don't even have the faith in Kim Jong-un to even show him these things, because the Chinese have never even invited Kim Jong-un to China. So I think there's a view in China that the idea of kind of showing their example to the North Koreans, and the North Koreans will hit the side of the head with the palm of their hand and say, oh, now we understand, we'll do that. Clearly, the Chinese are not so confident that's in the cards anymore, and they've never even bothered inviting him. So I think they understand that they have a big problem. The problem is they just don't have a consensus on what to do about it.
So they couldn't say, they couldn't threaten Kim by saying, look, either back off from this nuclear confrontation talk and activity, or we're going to cut you off economically. A threat like that might not be effective.
I think they are reluctant to go that way. That kind of resolves this whole indecisiveness in China, to be sure. And I think they're kind of moving in that direction, but they're moving slowly and they're moving against a lot of resistance. You have to remember there are 20 million police people in the sort of national security state there. And the idea of kind of going against a historic neighbor, a historic communist partner doesn't come naturally to a lot of these people. So it's taking them a while, but I think they are clearly heading in that direction. But as I said earlier, the question is whether the speed with which the Chinese move in that direction can catch up to the speed by which North Korea is busy fielding nuclear weapons.
So, Chris Hill, you were so deeply involved in the negotiations with Richard Holbrooke to end the war in Bosnia. And as I know you well remember, it was a combination of military action and diplomacy that brought about the peace accords there. What are the lessons that that experience would have for dealing with Korea? I mean, are military threats, if not military action itself, might they in some sense be helpful in terms of propelling diplomacy, or do parallels like that just don't add up?
I think there are contemporary parallels to the situation in Dayton, that is in the Bosnian peace settlement, where we created a kind of roadmap forward. We laid out what Bosnia will be. It'll be consistent of two entities, the Federation, the Bosnian Serb entity. We set up parliamentary systems, et cetera. And then we said, this is the future. And most Bosnians bought on. And the ones who didn't, the ones who were rejectionists, were the ones who were hit hard with aerial bombardment. Not a nice thing, but it was to use military force to enforce a political objective. Same thing was done in Kosovo. In my view, the same thing ought to be done in Syria, although no one's even moved that far to kind of lay out what the eventual, what Syria should look like. But with respect to Korea, I think the situation is different and not so amenable to that type of approach. And it has to do with the fact that North Korea has 14,000 artillery tubes, and they could create a lot of death and destruction among South Korean civilians in the northern part of South Korea. So to talk about a military solution in the Koreas is to say to the South Koreans, we feel this is necessary. They would agree. They would then move their population out of harm's way or into bunkers or whatever, and then go at it. But that's a very frightful prospect. So the idea of military strikes to get the North Koreans to, say, agree to what they already agreed to at the six-party talks is not a risk most people want to run.
Well, President Trump ordered a cruise missile, you could call it a pinprick strike, against an airfield in Syria as a means of sort of sending a message. What do you think would happen if the United States did a little sort of similar pinprick cruise missile strike against some isolated target in North Korea?
I don't know the answer to that. I don't think anyone does. But among the possibilities would be a pinprick assault on a South Korean civilian center with South Korean casualties. And so we would then need to respond to that. And so I'm not sure it's so easy. I don't think it's analogous to attacking a Syrian base, which essentially could not fire back at us. So I don't think it's an analogous situation when you talk about the North Korean military state and their capacity and their will to strike back hard at us, or at least strike back hard at South Korean civilians.
I'm going to jump right into highly classified security field here, and I expect you to be fully divulging. So in your experience in government, there must have been a lot of simulations done with respect to South Korea and North Korea, the possibility of, you know, playing out different scenarios. I would hope that those scenarios have been sort of imagined in every possible way.
You bet. And I've participated in some, and I'm happy to report that we win them all. But we don't win them all without loss of life. And so the question is, how much loss of life is one prepared to sustain? And since most of the loss of life involves South Korean citizens, we need to do these things together with the South Korean authorities.
How good is the anti-artillery defense in South Korea?
Robust, to put it mildly. It's been turned over to the South Koreans. It's extremely high tech, extremely computerized. And if I were a North Korean gunner, I would feel lucky to get off one shot.
Really? Mm-hmm. But still, you say that if there were military action, inevitably there would be South Korean casualties.
I never use words like inevitably, but there would be a high risk of that, yes.
Right. Let's talk about military options for a second. And even though I know you're not, your field is diplomacy and not military action, there are a lot of options that have been thrown around. The possibility of, you know, cyber sabotage of North Korean capabilities, also the possibility of sending a cruise missile across North Korea with some kind of electromagnetic pulse capability that could wipe out their electrical system without inflicting any casualties. Does the United States have some flexibility with respect to how it could actually intervene in North Korea?
Without getting into the specific technologies, I think it is very important, I would say vitally important, that we explore seriously this space between peace and all-out war. And I think the various points that you've raised are ones that really need to be looked at very hard. And if they are not being looked at, that is where I think our president needs to direct various agencies of government to look at these issues very carefully. The space between peace and war is the space I think we're going to have to occupy. I do not know why the North Korean missile Musudong has an 88% failure rate, but I would like to see all of their weapons have 88% failure rates, maybe even 100% failure rates. And I think we need to kind of really put our thinking caps on to see how that could be done.
President Trump has repeatedly made a point of saying he won't telegraph what he intends to do, whether in Syria or in North Korea or anywhere else.
I don't want to telegraph what I'm doing or what I'm thinking. I'm not like other administrations where they say we're going to do this in 4 weeks, and that doesn't work that way.
As a diplomat, does that make sense to you, or can that uncertainty work against your policy objectives?
There's always been in diplomacy this notion of creative ambiguity where the other side doesn't really know what you're going to do, and so they're reluctant to do something because they don't know what you're going to do. Certainly, the North Koreans have that because we're not really sure what they would do in response to some of our actions. But I think there's also a point at which there needs to be clarity, and clarity about our willingness to be engaged and involved in something. What we don't want is a situation where the South Korean people doubt our resolve, for example, to extend a nuclear umbrella to South Korea. I'm of the view that this issue of why North Korea has nuclear weapons is not about regime survival. I think the threat to the North Korean regime comes from within. I think the real issue is North Korea is trying to separate the United States from its allies so that they could create a situation where they attack South Korea, and should the U.S. participate in the counterattack, they would then hold the U.S. mainland hostage. Now, you could argue, yes, but then the U.S. could obliterate North Korea. Absolutely true. But the question a president would then have to think about is, do I want to give up a U.S. city for North Korea? So these types of calculations are the ones I think we need to be very careful about not having to get to. That is, we need to assure the South Korean people that that kind of dilemma, were it to be posed, would be answered in a way that the South Korean people would have confidence in our mental capacity, really, to live up to the treaty obligation to defend them. So these are tough issues, and I'd rather not get to the point where they can hold our cities hostage.
What do you think about the way President Trump has been talking about Kim Jong-un?
Any message for North Korea, sir? Kim Jong-un.
Gotta behave.
So you heard the president there, Wolf, say that they have to behave, they got to behave. And that
sometimes calling him a gentleman, sometimes talking about him like a misbehaving child. And, of course, some of his tweets have been pretty bombastic as well. I mean, is there a sort of a helpful aspect to that kind of rhetoric, or do you see that as counterproductive?
As a general rule, for example, when I was the negotiator with North Korea and earlier when I was negotiator with the Serbs and the Bosnians and the Albanians and the Serbs, you avoid sort of ad hominem attacks because it makes your job more difficult. If you need to talk to the other side, you don't want to say the other side's mother wears army boots. You don't want to insult them. You don't want to create these circumstances where you can't do your job effectively. This came up a lot of times with North Korea. Here was a country, probably the worst human rights offender in the world. And people were somehow offended at me for not kind of calling a spade, but I was trying to negotiate a nuclear deal. There's always John McCain who's available for saying whatever needs to be said about the leadership. So I think when you're engaged in something, you should be a little careful on these ad hominem comments.
Good enough. Ambassador Chris Hill, thanks so much for joining us. Great talking to you.
Thank you. My pleasure.
All right. So long. And now a quick break.
Decius Daily.
Decius Daily.
Decius Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
Decius Daily. Sign up at decius.com/newsletter.
decius.com/newsletter.
And we're back. And on the line with us, Alan Wolfe, professor at Boston College. Till recently, he directed the Boise Center for Religion and American Public Life. Thanks for joining us, Alan Wolfe.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
So we had an interesting case come before the Supreme Court this week about whether a church in Missouri could be denied state funds. And at issue there was a provision in the Missouri Constitution that upheld church-state separation. And what I found interesting in this is that that provision dates from 1820. Can you imagine a conservative state like Missouri passing a law now or a constitutional amendment that would be as firm in separating the church and state as that provision did back in 1820?
No, that would be totally impossible to imagine. The 1820 date, by the way, is really significant for another reason, and that is that some people attribute these separation of church and state constitutions as a reaction against Catholicism. The fear was that Catholics would overwhelm the Protestants, and so they had to prevent Catholics from using the state to further their own aims. But 1820 is well before the Catholic immigration, so you really can't blame that one on anti-Catholicism. That was a Protestant decision to separate church and state.
And today, we see the Baptists who are most concerned about church-state separation being something that works against them. They want to have permission to pray in schools. They want, in this case, you know, they want churches to be able to receive state funding. Where were the Baptists as a Protestant sect on this issue, you know, 200, 250 years ago?
Baptists back then knew the history of the Baptist Church in America. They knew that Roger Williams and Anne Hutchison, that these were people who were rebellious, who were against the establishment, who were deeply religious, but were also strong opponents of the idea of blending politics and religion, precisely because they were religious.
And what was their fear of the state? What was their fear that the state would do with respect to their religious freedom?
They had had examples, because they were a dissenting church in England, of all kinds of efforts by government to control them, to direct their activities, to suppress any sense that a government or an establishment might have that religion could constitute a challenge to political power. After all, the two great institutions of power in any country, really, are the church and the state. And having the one be wary of the other provides a kind of balance that works against the danger of these two huge centers of power working hand in hand.
And yet the term religious freedom has come to mean something quite different in the context of today's politics.
Yeah, I was actually quite shocked when about 20, 25 years ago, I was at a meeting and someone started talking about religious freedom and my ears perked up. Oh, you know, I haven't heard that term in a while. But I quickly realized he was talking about the freedom of churches to essentially get away with anything they wanted. Religious freedom for him was an excuse for a church to practice discrimination against anyone it didn't like. Now that's a sort of big thing. But when I heard the first inklings of it, I just couldn't believe my ears.
Well, now it's associated with, you know, an assertion of the right to pray in schools, mm-hmm. for example, or in government mm-hmm. meetings, Bible reading and so forth. What would the early Protestants what would their feeling have been about prayer in schools, just to give one example?
Mm-hmm. I mean, for them, the state was like Mephistopheles. The state was like the devil. It had designs on believers. And if you entered into an alliance with the state, it was like entering into an alliance with the devil. There would be a certainty, I think, in their view, that when church and state came together, that the state would always win and the church would always lose. And I think there was some justification for feeling that way.
You know, Francis Fitzgerald has a new book out called The Evangelicals, and I know you reviewed it for the New York Times. Mm-hmm. And she talks in that book about the sort of the evolution of evangelical thinking over the years on mm-hmm. this very issue. I mean, it seems like it's been almost a complete reversal.
Yeah, and you don't have to go back to 1820. The infamous Roe versus Wade decision of 1973, which everyone says began our cultures, the Southern Baptist Convention actually supported Roe versus Wade and supported a woman's right to have an abortion. Cynics say they did that because Catholics were against it, and Asian Catholics were against Baptists would be for, and there's probably some truth in that. But they also opposed it because they saw that if you gave the state the ability to tell a woman what she could do with her body, it was a short step to the state telling any believer what they could do with their mind. And they saw a great potential danger in that. That didn't last that long. By the time of the Reagan administration, Southern Baptist Convention was fully on board with the way things are seen today. So, you know, it did take a while. And to this very day, there are centers of resistance to this Baptist association with the state. At Baylor University, which is anything but a liberal university, there's a Center for Church-State Relations that keeps alive the old Baptist tradition of separation of church and state. And there are Baptist intellectuals who remember this history. But for your ordinary Southern Baptist, it's a completely different story now.
And there is something called, which I'm sure you're aware of, the Baptist Joint Committee for Religious Liberty, which actually filed an amicus brief on behalf of this, the idea of church-state separation in this Missouri case this week.
Yeah. One of the things about the Missouri case that really strikes me as important to point out is that by the latter part of the 19th century, when James G. Blaine ran for president and it was Romanism and rebellion, a significant anti-Catholic impetus, states denied, as I said, Protestant states denied funds to the Catholic Church. Well, the result of that was that the Catholic Church created a wonderful world, the world of Catholic schools, of Catholic universities, of Catholic hospitals. Without the state's help, they invented a whole civil society. And by the way, it's a civil society that eventually wasn't close to Catholics. A lot of Jews teach at Catholic universities, including yours truly. So that's actually a very powerful idea, that you don't need the state for religion to flourish. And in fact, some religions will flourish much better without the state than with it.
So you've been teaching for many years at Boston College, which is, as you say, an old Catholic institution. The Catholic Church has weighed in a lot on this religious freedom issue as well lately, because they feel that the state has been compelling them to endorse same-sex marriage or to accommodate same-sex couples. I'm sure that this has been an issue even at Boston College.
Yes, it is. But, you know, it's again an example of churches reversing themselves, because just as the Baptists were separationists who've now become what we call accommodationists, the Catholic Church always believed in the state. It's the Catholic Church, almost no one knows it, but it's the Catholic Church that essentially was responsible for these very impressive welfare states in Europe. It wasn't the socialists. It was the Catholics who wanted to see the state be involved in, you know, helping people with their lives and providing support for them when they were disabled and so on. So for the church now to go over to the Catholic Church to go over to the religious freedom side, it's abandoning its history, just as the Baptists are, as they shift positions on this.
So if you take a really long view of this, you see quite a major evolution of the whole concept of religious freedom and of church-state separation over the last 200 years.
Yeah, you really do. I think really conservative religious believers will tell you that the secularists, the secular humanists, and the liberals have won. I think secular humanists will tell you that the religious believers are more powerful than ever. They're both right in a sense. It's just that everyone's position on this issue changes. Now, that probably shouldn't happen according to the way some people view religion. Religion is supposed to be about timeless truths. But we know that there's no such thing as timelessness when it comes to religion, and particularly American religion, that we live in a very dynamic society in which everything is changing all the time. You know, as people move around, as they upwardly or downwardly mobile, how could you ever expect them to live according to eternal truth? It just doesn't happen.
Fascinating history. Thank you so much, Alan Wolfe, for talking to us.
My pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
Bye-bye. And for this week, from the archives, in our first segment, we talked about the tensions with North Korea. Back in 2012, as guest host on the Diane Rehm Show, I spoke with a PBS Frontline reporter who told a remarkable story of a man born in a North Korean labor camp. He was starved, tortured, and forced to watch the execution of his mother and brother. Miraculously, he managed to escape and find his way to freedom.
Let me read something that you wrote about Shin, this young man who was born in the North Korean labor camp, lived there until he was 23, right, and then managed to escape. You write, he had to learn that a civilized child should love his mother. In the years after he escaped the camp, Shin learned that many people associate warmth, security, and affection with the words mother, father, and brother. That was not his experience. You also write, his mother beat him, and he viewed her as a competitor for food. His father, who was allowed by guards to sleep with his mother just five nights a year, ignored him. His brother was a stranger. You say that for Shin, God did not disappear or die. Shin had never heard of him. It's really a different universe, not of this world.
It's not of this world, and since he was born in the camp, he was sort of bred to accept that world. His parents were chosen as part of a reward marriage, and he was bred kind of like a farm animal to be labor in the camp.
And you don't mean that as an overstatement by any means, do you?
No. He received a very minimal education, enough to read and write at a minimal level, to help him do some of the jobs in the camp. But he did not learn about life outside the camp or in North Korea or in the outside world. He was 23 when he met a new prisoner named Park who came to the camp. And this guy basically gave Shin, in the course of 2 months, a primer on what it means to be a citizen of the world. He told him that the world was round. He told him that China and South Korea existed, about the United States, about telephones and television and things like that. But what motivated Shin to want to get out of the camp is that Park also talked about food, mm-hmm. particularly grilled meat that one could eat if one went to a restaurant in China. And it was the idea of having your stomach full of grilled meat, that any person could enjoy that, was that sparked dreams and aspirations and the willingness to try to get out of there.
You can listen to the entire show on dianereem.org. That's our show for this week. Let us know what's on your mind. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851. Or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden and comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Sandra Baker and Rebecca Kaufman. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Gelton of NPR News.